You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
Hello and welcome to Security Unlocked, a new podcast from Microsoft where we unlock insights from the latest in news and research from across Microsoft's security engineering and operations teams. I'm Nick Fillingham.
And I'm Natalia Gadilla. In each episode, we'll discuss the latest stories from Microsoft security, deep dive into the newest threat intel, research, and data science.
And profile some of the fascinating people working on artificial intelligence in Microsoft security.
And now, let's unlock the pod.
Hello, listeners. Hello, Natalia. Welcome to episode 37 of Security Unlocked. On today's podcast, we are joined by Jonathan Barr-Orr, who is the author of a blog from June 30th, 2021, in which Jonathan talks about discovering some firmware vulnerabilities in networking hardware and how he went about, first of all, discovering those vulnerabilities and then working with the vendor to get them resolved. It is a fascinating conversation because it really starts in one place, which is Jonathan basically helping test the efficacy and accuracy of a machine learning model. And it ends in Jonathan sort of working hand in hand with this network manufacturing company to get some pretty gnarly vulnerabilities addressed.
Many of us have seen the recent stats on the rising number of firmware attacks or attacks via internet-facing systems. And as we all continue to live this hybrid remote work life, we recognize that our weakest link can be the home network infrastructure that companies now have to secure since the infrastructure extends well beyond the office now. Jonathan is super great at describing this really technical investigation, and he uses a ton of acronyms that I think would be worthwhile to cover off here before we dive into the substance of the episode.
Yeah, Jonathan talks about TLS encryption. I think our audience is pretty familiar with that, transport layer security, which is the successor to SSL. The other one that was used quite a bit was NVRAM, and that's short for non-volatile random access memory, which is memory that saves its stored data regardless of whether the power is on or off. Any other acronyms you got on your list there?
He does also reference QEMU, which is a open source tool that performs hardware virtualization, and he uses that in the course of his investigation. So you'll get to hear a real live use case for that solution. I do have to pause and just give serious kudos to Jonathan, because in the episode, as he's describing these vulnerabilities and how they occurred, he defines side channel attacks to us. And he does this by setting up a riddle and describing the analogy that supports that riddle using a classroom with 40 children trying to ace an exam.
Yep, we'll leave it there. That's the tease. It's a fantastic analogy. I think you'll enjoy this episode. On with the pod.
On with the pod.
Welcome to the Security Unlocked podcast, Jonathan Barr-Orr. Jonathan, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Jonathan, if you could give us a quick introduction to yourself. What do you do at Microsoft? What's your job description? But what's your day-to-day look like?
So I'm a security researcher in Microsoft. I've been in Microsoft for the last 5 years, give or take. And I've been focusing on a mix between red teaming and blue teaming, also known as purple teaming, mostly on the Microsoft Defender world. So both antivirus and post-breach solutions. Currently, I'm doing the research architecture for the cross-platform solution for Microsoft Defender for Endpoint.
Got it. So on today's episode, we're going to talk about a blog post that you authored on June the 30th around some vulnerabilities that were found in some network hardware. Before we jump into that blog post, though, I'd love to sort of understand a little bit about your background. We're going to talk about firmware. We're going to talk about sort of unpacking firmware. We're going to talk about sort of low-level decryption. Can you tell us about your path to Microsoft and your role and as it pertains to what we're going to talk about in this blog post?
So as I said, in the last 5 years, I've been Microsoft, and I was a part of a team that looked at all the security techniques that were available both for pre-breach and post-breach, and was tasked with both simulating them, finding new techniques and detecting these or even preventing these. So if you look, for instance, at what MITRE attack metrics, how it looks today, then we kind of created that even before the MITRE attack metrics was existed. It was created internally. And then initially, I was responsible for the lateral movement aspect of the attack, moved towards looking at kernel exploits, everything that's related to exploitation, really moved towards tamper protection, because one of the things that we really want to have is a product that can't be easily tampered with, right? Especially because attackers nowadays, at least in Windows, heavily rely on running as administrator. So it's quite a challenge. Later, I joined a team that does kind of a mix between attacks on the endpoint and attacks on the cloud itself. So if you look at attacks today, you'll see, let's say, tools like Ruler, right, which is an attack tool, in which if someone compromised your Outlook account online, they can basically breach your endpoint, right? So everything now is basically a mishmash of attacks, and you have to kind of coordinate how the endpoint and the cloud work together. As a part of that effort, I was also tasked with kind of leading, technically at least, the network detection and response effort that became basically the network device discovery solution that is basically described in the blog post. As a part of that effort, I also looked at some firmware vulnerabilities, because we know our customers sometimes are not only they're vulnerable, but also they don't know that they're vulnerable. They don't know what's on their network. So that was kind of a huge effort. And I would say that 99% of my work there was really describing kind of the attacks themselves and how to fingerprint devices correctly. The 1% that is basically, you know, resulted in the blog post is basically looking more deeper into what attackers could do with network equipment.
Thank you, John. That's a great setup. So the blog post we're going to talk about today, or the work we're going to talk about today, is from this June 30th blog post. So you basically, I'll paraphrase and I'll have you sort of correct my oversimplification, but you noticed some anomalies coming from a very specific router made by another company, and basically went through the process of decrypting or extracting the firmware, looking into the firmware and finding up, I think it was 3 vulnerabilities. And then you sort of went through a disclosure process with the company and ultimately got that fixed. I think in today's conversation, I'd love sort of a chronological walkthrough of how this happened. How was my summary? Did I get that right? What's the sort of TLDR for this blog post?
You were absolutely correct. I don't need to correct you. That was 100% correct. So basically what happened is we, with time, right, we started getting our data from our customers, and we started realizing that we have an issue, right? Because there are known network equipment vulnerabilities that are very, sometimes might seem even very reliable for attackers, right? And we actually see that attackers are moving away from modern operating systems because they're so hardened these days. In the past, you could have just exploited, you know, found basically like a memory corruption vulnerability and you'd get code execution. And these days you have so many technologies. The known ones are, of course, non-execution, the NX-bit or DEP. That's how it's called on Windows, and also ASLR that randomizes how modules are laid out in memory. Of course, that's not bulletproof, but these days you have so many other technologies. CFG is one of them. There are, you know, sandboxes inside Windows and other operating systems as well. New hardware vendors are implementing pointer authentication. So all of these things make life really, really difficult for attackers to attack or modern operating systems, not just Windows, everything, right? Linux, Mac are really hardened well. And again, because of that, attackers tend to move away from those things where network equipment and all of these things, because they're easier to target and continue from there. So basically, the problem is that a lot of the network traffic between these network equipment and the modern operating system or endpoints is encrypted. In this case, it was TLS encrypted. So one of the things that I started doing with our machine learning folks is basically to train a model that would say, this network connection is an anomaly, even though we can't really tell what's inside because we can't decrypt it, right? Both technically and also legally. And basically the idea was, okay, so let's say, I don't know, I'll give you a scenario. I'm not an IT person. I'm just working at some company. You know, at a certain point in time, let's say at midnight, we see that my machine tries to log on into a router's management port, right? That's not something that should normally happen, right? I'm not an IT person. I'm not supposed to do that. And then our solution is supposed to basically flag that and say, oh, this is an anomalous connection. So just based on time, the type of machine that I have, and so on. And so basically we started training these models and they work pretty well. We simulated some attacks, known attacks on various webcams and routers and whatnot. And then basically started getting feedback from the field, from our customers. At a certain point, we found one of these cases and it was really weird. It was kind of almost like this scenario that I just described. Basically, a non-IT person connecting to a router at, I wouldn't say midnight, but over the weekend at a very interesting hour when no one is supposed to be awake, hopefully. So basically, the problem now is okay, we have an anomaly, but how do we prove that it's actually bad? And this is where I started my research from, if that makes sense.
Yes, it does. And why did you decide to pursue an investigation on this particular anomaly?
To be completely transparent, we wanted to know that our machine learning models work well because up until this point, we just tested them synthetically. As in, we trained them and we ran some attacks, simulated some of them, but we didn't know exactly how they would really work in the field. So imagine that you train your machine learning model and you test it and they look good. And now you dispatch them to the field to customers in a non-enforcing mode still, because we want to get feedback from the field before releasing it, you know, publicly. And then you get a hit, right? You get an actual anomaly hit. And now you basically want to, as a researcher, you want to understand what happens there, right? And the only way, because I got the network communication recorded, but because it's encrypted, I wasn't able to do anything. At this point, what I decided to do is basically try to prove to myself that it could have been such an attack or at least an attempt, right? It would be very hard for us, to be honest, to tell the difference between, you know, an attacker trying to exploit something like what I found and just an attacker trying to scan the network and look for just, you know, even trying to brute force, let's say, the management port of the router. So we still don't know exactly what happened there, but we suspect it might have been one of these cases.
And Jonathan, were you actively hunting? Or were you still in sort of model training, model verification mode? I think you mentioned this was customer data. These were network equipment actually out in a customer in production running one of the Microsoft Defender for endpoint services. Is that right?
It was a design partner. That's how they are called, because it was before the general availability of our product. And yes, I was actively hunting. We have good machine learning folks that are far, far better than me and more proficient in these worlds. So all the credit goes to them. And basically what I tried doing is to prove to our, basically to our leadership and also to ourselves and to our machine learning team that their efforts, you know, actually bear some fruit. And then one thing that I would like to mention is the fact that a lot of these design partners, once we ran our solution, were really shocked to discover how many things there are in the network that they didn't even know about. Starting from, you know, Raspberry Pis that employees just brought, you know, just logged into their network, following with vulnerable web cameras that were just there, printers that were just unknown to these folks. And we also discovered a bunch of network configuration issues. For instance, we discovered some devices that just had open telnets, which basically means that if someone runs in the network, they can just run arbitrary code on these machines. So we started from there, right? And that router was also one of these things that were just really weird to see, because basically it's mostly used as a home router, as far as I understand. But nevertheless, we found it on a customer's network.
So you mentioned there were a few surprises. What were the patterns? Were there a particular set of devices that were more commonly identified, like more Raspberry Pis versus routers that were previously unidentified to the customer? And like how many new devices on average?
I would say that they're case-by-case basis, right? It really depends on the customer. For some customers, we found interesting, I think it was around 20-something Raspberry Pis that were just like they didn't know of. The open telnet issues were found on a different customer. The vulnerable web cameras were found on a very sensitive kind of design partner. So it was really alarming to see, but we didn't draw any patterns. We did, however, try to improve our fingerprinting with time, right? So if initially we had fingerprinting for just the most popular vendors, and with time we started getting a lot of unknown classifications, so we had to improve with time. And this thing is not, you know, it's not a sprint, it's a marathon. So basically, we always get one of these like unknown devices, and then we have to fingerprint them one way or another. But I guess it's kind of a different story.
I don't want to digress into a sort of a product pitch here, but Jonathan, the actual sort of feature or the product that this work, that you, this machine learning that you talked about and the work that you're supporting, this is a part of Microsoft Defender for Endpoint. So it's the ability for the Microsoft Defender for Endpoint service to run a process, a service that can fingerprint all the devices on a network and then sort of return a view, a sort of a device discovery sort of capability inside the product. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. And after the release of that feature, known as the network device discovery feature, we actually acquired two companies that are very focused on network equipment and also IoT. These are CyberX and Refirm Labs. Both of these companies are very proficient at what they're doing. And currently what we're doing is really to get their knowledge absorbed into the product so we can actually do even better. But yes, this is a part of the suite.
Awesome. So you saw that the model flagged an anomaly. You thought, I want to investigate this and, you know, see that the model's actually doing what it should. What was the next step? Did you just physically go and procure one of these network devices, or was it still unclear what the actual device was? Did you have to do some more investigation to find was the MAC address there? Could you look up the MAC address and work out what the model number was, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, so basically from the MAC address, there is an OUI that you can get. Like that's the three first octets of a MAC address. And you can kind of conclude who the manufacturer is. And then we actually asked permission from the design partner to actually work with them and try to identify the device. Once we identified the device, we still haven't purchased one of these devices because, you know, we had to prove to ourselves that this is really an interesting case before purchasing a bunch of routers. But we did. One of the things that I started doing is to try to, with the design partner, try to actively fingerprint the firmware. And I was able to do that with not a lot of difficulties. And then what I decided to do is just downloading the actual firmware from the vendor's website, which was and still is available, and basically try to analyze it statically, as in without running it, without doing anything. And that's where I found, I think, the first vulnerability there. And after I found the first vulnerability, I basically pushed for us to acquire one of these devices. Actually, two, because we were afraid to break one of them. And basically try to find more interesting issues there. So we did. We ended up buying that. Before buying that, one of the things that I did was to emulate the firmware. And you can do that with tools like Wemu. That's the number one tool probably to do that. But you have to basically simulate some things that are out of your control. in this router's case, it's basically the entire NVRAM. So you need to do a bunch of hacky stuff to actually emulate it and make it happy so it runs smoothly. So I was able to do it, but not for the entire router. And sometimes it crashed. And this is why we decided to actually buy one of these things.
So just stepping back for a minute, can you walk us through what the three vulnerabilities you identified were and TLDR and how you got to identifying that particular vulnerability?
Yeah. So as I mentioned, the anomalous network connection was to the router's management port. The router keeps a bunch of listening ports open, and one of them is a management utility over HTTP. Or in this case, it was HTTPS because it was TLS protected.
And John, I'm going to jump in. Jonathan, yeah. So if anyone listening to the podcast has had experience either playing with routers or even the one at home, are we talking about the exact same thing where, you know, you set up your router for the first time and you go to 192.168.1.something and then a web page loads and you enter in like a default username and password and there are the settings for the router? Is that when you say management console, is that what you're referring to?
Yeah, that's the one.
Got it.
And then the three vulnerabilities were basically an authentication bypass, where basically you can, without knowing the username and password to the router, you can basically log in and do whatever you like. That was vulnerability number one. Vulnerability number two was another, I would call it probably not just authentication bypass, but a side channel attack on the username password verification. So you can basically, with a very low number of, well, relatively low number of attempts, basically conclude what the username passwords are. And third vulnerability is basically kind of a broken cryptography case where basically the vendor used a baked-in password to encrypt something. And then, of course, encryption doesn't mean anything if an attacker knows the password. And the password, again, is embedded in the binary, which is somewhere buried in the firmware. So it's more like obfuscation, really, than encryption. So that was the third vulnerability, which is, I'd like to say, less severe than the other two.
And you made a point of distinguishing authentication bypass from a side channel attack. Can you tell us what's the definition of each of those? What differentiates those two types of vulnerabilities?
Well, the authentication bypass is basically when in this case, the router, but generically any system that requires a username password, and you just somehow bypass that the requirement, basically making the system believe that you're authenticated. That's the authentication bypass. The side channel attack relies on in this case, time differences of the system responding to an attempt, right? To a username password attempt, which basically allows an attacker to conclude the username and password. And if you're coming from a cryptography background, this is something that is basically a cryptographic vulnerability.
So I loved reading your description of how you did the sort of secret retrieval and were able to, you know, ascertain the username and password. Is there anything about that technique that, I mean, so I'm not a security researcher, so this, to me, this is all new and very interesting, but the techniques that you went through to do this, was this all, you know, folks listening to the podcast that do this kind of work pretty standard, or did you have to sort of really, really think outside the box and sort of be creative here in your approach?
I mean, there are certain things that when you look statically at the binary and you start to reverse engineer it, you'd look for certain patterns and certain function invocations. In this case, actually, that approach led me to both of these vulnerabilities, right? The authentication bypass and the side channel attack, where in the authentication bypass, I found that the vendor was using the notorious C function STR-STR. And in the side channel attack, the vendor was using STR-CMP for string comparison. So when you get, you know, experience in exploitation, you kind of try to look for all of these unsafe functions in a binary. And then what I was really looking for is basically a memory corruption issue, right? This is usually the case with these things. But I found basically these two issues are logical bugs, right? Specifically, the side channel attack if I may, I actually tried to explain that to my cousin with kind of a riddle. So what I told her is that imagine that you're in high school, right? And your teacher is giving you basically a pop quiz, like to the entire class. It's only a pop quiz with 10 questions, okay? 10 questions with multiple choice even. So 4 options for each question, right? So you have 10 questions with 4 options each. And the teacher basically announces to the entire class that if someone aces the test, then the entire class passes. Otherwise, everyone fail. Now, the teacher basically checks every test in front of the students and takes, let's say, a second to check each answer, right? And of course, the teacher doesn't want to waste her time and doesn't want to check a paper that's not perfect. So the teacher basically stops at the first mistake, right? So let's say that you submitted your test with 3 and the third answer is a mistake. So it'll take the teacher 3 seconds to basically say, oh, you fail. The problem is that we're all very bad students and no one actually knows the answer to any of the questions, right? So how can you guys really pass the test given the fact that there are just 40 students? That's the riddle. And the answer is basically the side channel attack. So of course, each answer has 4 options. So normally you would need over like a million attempts, right? So you need a million students to actually guess every combination. But what the students can do is to measure the time it takes for the teacher to check each submission, right? So let's say the first student tries question 1 with option 1 checked, right? And then if the teacher takes more than 1 second to say fail, then everyone knows because everyone's present when the teacher checks. Everyone knows that the first answer is answer number 1. If the teacher takes a second or less, let's say, then the second student can actually try answer number 2 for question number 1, and so on and so forth, right? And then if you calculate it, you understand that for each answer besides the last answer, you need only 3 attempts to really conclude the right answer, right? So if all first three students fail, then fourth answer is the one that's right. So basically, we need 3 times 9 plus 10, which is 37 attempts. So you even have 3 students extra. And this is how you solve the riddle. And this is exactly how the side channel works, right? You basically rely on the fact that they run strcmp or string compare, which is a lazy function, just like the teacher. It basically stops whenever there is a mismatch. So if we do an attempt and measure the time it takes for the router to respond bad username password, we can actually conclude whether our first character, let's say, was correct or not. And if it was, then continue to the next character and so on. So this is how the side channel attack works.
Tell me what you were like in high school, Jonathan. Were you, did you pull together 37, 36 of your friends with stopwatches? And
I wish I had 37 friends. I'm kidding.
Wow, there's some unintended sort of therapy happening here in the podcast.
Now that you've gone through this process, you know, what's the takeaway for customers here? As we started to talk about earlier in the conversation today, routers, firmware, this is a new threat vector or one that is increasingly being considered by threat actors. Do we have guidance to customers on what they should use, how they should use our products to help secure themselves?
Yeah, generically, I would say that we see a trend of attackers moving away from the endpoint. This connects well to what I said about the cloud, and it connects well to what I said about network equipment. Basically, network equipment and, you know, IoT and what I call devices, basically. So IoT is just one branch of them, is significantly less secure than modern operating systems, sometimes because it has to, due to performance, due to size limits. This world is just very rich and much less secure than modern operating systems. So I would say that to customers that, first of all, be aware of what happens in your network. And one of the ways that you can do that is of course, with a network device discovery solution, such as the one that we're offering. Basically, all of the regular IT management is still relevant here. So for example, making sure that all of your solutions are patched, make sure that you get the latest firmware from vendors. And it's not a very easy thing to do in many cases, especially for all of these devices. A, because sometimes our customers are really not aware of what happens in their network and what's connected to the network. And secondly, because sometimes it means actually manually upgrading firmware. So this is not a very easy task, but it has to be done if you want to be secure. So unfortunately, it's not a very easy thing to do, but it must be done.
And so that's what's next for you. You'll be identifying ahead of time another investigation to kick off based on what you find?
Well, when you say for me, it could really be interpreted as two different things. For that product and the product team, yes, they're going to do that. And as I said, they're working hard now to make sure that all of the knowledge from CyberX and Reform Labs is being absorbed, if you will, into the product to make us even greater. For me personally, as I said, I'm now working on cross-platform for the Defender for Endpoint, but I'm hoping to achieve similar fits there if I get lucky. So if I may add, I'd like to thank not only the vulnerability coordination team, but also, of course, to Netgear, that we're very responsive and reactive and work closely with us to make sure that all customers are protected.
Fantastic. Well, Jonathan Barwell, thank you so much for your time. I really enjoyed reading your blog post. I'd love to learn more about your, I was about to say exploits, but I think in this context, that's the wrong word. I'd love to learn about your investigations in the future, looking for vulnerabilities in lots of different pieces of technology. We'd love to have you back on the Security Unlocked podcast at some point in the future.
Sounds good. Waiting to find more things and come back to your podcast.
Well, we had a great time unlocking insights into security, from research to artificial intelligence. Keep an eye out for our next episode.
And don't forget to tweet us at MSFTSecurity or email us at securityunlocked@microsoft.com with topics you'd like to hear on a future episode. Until then, stay safe.
Stay secure.
This week on the Microsoft Threat Intelligence Podcast, join us as we dig deep into the XZ backdoor with its finder, Andreas Freund, and senior security researcher, Thomas Rochia. Be sure to listen in and follow us at msthreatintelpodcast.com or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.